You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, September 18th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Oh, did I say live? I meant live to tape. Sue me. It's, I am still out celebrating the Jewish New Year to return tomorrow live. I'm actually speaking from the distant past into the future and then projecting out one day further into the future. I'm sorry, folks. I don't mean to get all temporally screwy with you, but that's just the reality. However, even though I'm not here live, as we normally are, I did pre-tape a new interview, so you will be enjoying fresh content. Christina Rizga, writer from Mother Jones Magazine, has embedded herself in a high school in San Francisco, a supposedly failing school. She's been there for over a year. She intends to be there for another year going forward. And I had a chance to talk to her from San Francisco. She was in San Francisco. I'm in New York. Last week. And we'll get to that interview in just a moment. Don't forget, folks, strangeangels.com. They have an event September 23rd. They are one of our sponsors this month. JustCoffee.coop, Fair Trade, Organic Tea, Coffee, Madison, co-op-owned company. Coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. You can get the Majority Report blend. All that, many different ways to support the program in addition to becoming a member at majority.fm. I will be back live tomorrow. In the meantime, enjoy this interview, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Sam Cedar. He puts the truth inside your radio.
We are back on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program a writer for Mother Jones Magazine, Christina Rizga. She has written a piece in the September-October 2012 issue entitled "Everything You've Heard About Failing Schools is Wrong." Welcome to the program, Christina.
Thank you, Sam. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, first off, before we get to sort of what you've learned in your extended embedded time in a school, first talk about how difficult it is. And because it's very rare, I've been looking for stories like this quite often. It's very rare to hear that someone was able to essentially spend, you spent 18 months, are you still in the process of doing that, embedded in a school?
That's right, yes. I've been there for 18 months, and I feel that I'm even after 18 months, just scratching the surface of it, and I'm planning to stay there for 3 years.
And you're planning to stay. Tell us what school it is that you've been embedded in.
Sure. So it's Mission High School in San Francisco. It is considered, if you look at the statistics gathered by state and federal lawmakers, the school appears on the list of 5% of the lowest performing schools in the country. But if you actually look at other data, which I've been doing for 18 months there, if you look at the quality of student work, the grade distribution, the grades are going up for African-American Latino students. If you look at their college enrollment, which is 88% this year and last year, 55% of which is UCs and CSUs, student-parent opinions about the school, attendance, graduation rates, suspensions, expulsions, all of that data is looking really good. But because, they use primarily student test scores to look at schools, it appears on this list of failing schools. Now, this school in San Francisco, it's important to keep in mind, it's a school where students often that, are not doing well at other schools end up there. 47% Mission High School has students from 47 different countries attending, 72% poor, 40%
Now, let me ask
Latino.
You a question. Christina, let me just stop you there. You wrote this in your piece. It has students from 47 different countries. I mean, these are first-generation immigrants.
Fourth generation, absolutely. A fifth of these students have been in the U.S. for less than 2 years. And, of course, the student that I profile, right, when she enters Mission High School, she doesn't speak English. She's a very bright student from El Salvador who lived in a small rural village, very small school with mud floors, one teacher teaching all grades. So she enters the school, with no English skills. She doesn't know how to multiply. And this is what, where she's at when she enters the ninth grade.
Okay. Now, Christina, could you just take 1 second, just back off your phone receiver just a little bit, because it's just breaking up a little bit. Let me just.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
Let me hear that.
Okay. I'm going to move. I'm going to move to a different area.
Okay.
Sorry about that. Hopefully that helps. I was looking at my street. I work from home, and no one has a landline anymore.
I understand.
But I need to. I will get one as I'm doing more radio interviews these days. Okay, I'm in the best zone right now.
Okay, that's good. And just sort of just back off just a little bit off. What? Oh, will you count down mm-hmm. from
sure.
10?
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 4. 3, 2, 1.
Great. That sounds good.
Was that better? Oh, good.
Yeah. Just try and back off a little bit off the mic, just not keep the phone that close. Are you on a headset mm-hmm. or no?
No, I'm not. Is that usually better?
It depends.
Okay. I'm backing off.
Okay. So we'll pick it up from there. So Maria, this student that you write about in this piece, entered in ninth grade, she has, mm-hmm. she doesn't speak any English. And so you detail how she is not just helped, but I mean, really there's a tremendous amount of attention paid to her, by the teachers there. And was that indicative of the relationship between the teachers and the students?
Absolutely. I mean, it's not an uncommon story at Mission High School. One of the first surprising things that I discovered when I got to Mission High School, even though it's on this list of failing schools, within the first 2 weeks, I failed to find, even a single student who said, "Oh, I hate it here. This is a horrible school." Most students expressed love for their school. And, when you look at the parent and student satisfaction surveys, they're among the highest in the city. And Mission High School, even though they educate 925 students, and as I mentioned, from 47 different countries, they place a huge emphasis on, making sure that pretty much every teacher, tries to remember everyone's name. The principal for sure seems to know every student's name. So students feel extremely noticed. and respected throughout the school. And it's, you know, a lot of Mission High teachers saw me, and a lot of students, they came from other schools, you know, told me who were kicked out from other schools or didn't, you know, survive in other schools. The first thing I'll tell you is, like, I wasn't noticed. No one cared. You know, teachers didn't notice me. I didn't feel respected. And that's sort of one thing that Mission High School teachers do really well.
And so, I mean, this sounds like a great school. I mean, you know, based upon I send my child to a public school here in New York, and, you know, the idea that she would get that type of attention from teachers, for the most part she does, but I mean, that's basically what you covet as a parent. So how is it that this school is on a list of closing schools? Or maybe, well, let's put it this way. Let's back up a little bit. Under what program is this school operating now that it's on one of these lists?
Mm-hmm. So it's a part of, you know, it's in this program initiated by President Obama, Race to the Top, and part of it is called Student Improvement Grants. And it's actually, you know, in many ways, so it's a continuation of No Child Left Behind in the sense that, you know, we're using primarily test scores to identify schools that are successful and those that are failing. The new addition under SIG, School Improvement Grant, is that it actually, you know, in addition sort of to these sticks that identify failing schools and then, you know, sign them up for radical restructuring or closure, it comes with additional funds. So it actually includes some carrots, you know, in this program. And so Mission High School essentially, you know, in 2010 was placed on this list, and it has 3 more years. You know, it gets additional funding, which is significant. You know, in a recession, significant funding, 20% of their funding comes from this grant. But within 3 years, they have to show continued increases in these test scores or else. Now, what's going to happen at the end? No one really knows, but from what we've seen, every time a school goes through some sort of radical restructuring, right, the next round is even deeper, is even more radical. So it could include possible closure. It could include, you know, removal of the principal. No one really knows.
But it seems to me that so there is some funding that goes to, I guess, theoretically, raising the test score, right? I mean, isn't that that seems to be the nub of the problem? Is that you can send extra money to raise the test scores, but you're not necessarily improving the educational experience. In fact, I mean, give me your sense as to whether or not you're actually hurting it.
I mean, I really think that in many cases it sort of creates, you know, more harm than good. At Mission High School, it's sort of succeeding in spite of No Child Left Behind. Most teachers believe that test score, you know, at Mission High School, believe that test scores show a very narrow slice of the information. So there's no pressure from the principal directly to raise and focus on test scores. And that's why, in many ways, it is improving, because they're focusing on much more important things like improving the quality of student work, looking at grades, right? Breaking up grades by ethnicity, by teacher, looking at how students are doing, by looking at their work, right? Thinking and working collaboratively to decide sort of what is the real evidence of student learning, which is very complicated, right? How do we measure that? How do we assess that? They're doing all of that sort of in spite of No Child Left Behind and the fact that it's asking schools to focus on these test scores, but that's not the case. You know, study after study, when academics and researchers go into schools and they look at how schools have been doing in the last 10 years, you know, the curriculum is narrowed. There's a lot of emphasis to teaching to the test. And there's some research that shows that, you know, even high-scoring charters place a lot of emphasis on that. So it's, you know, in many ways, it's sort of diverting attention from things that really matter, the quality of student work and collaboration and mentorship with teachers, and sort of diverting these scarce resources to increase test scores.
I mean, so what's the, you know, so what is the the ongoing fascination. I mean, I guess it's somewhat obvious, but we'll walk us through this. I mean, why, assuming that people have the best of intentions and obviously want to improve schools and education across the country, and assuming for the moment, which I don't think is, you know, maybe that's safe to assume, but assuming that people wanted education as widely available and access it for as many people as possible, what is the theoretical value of using this high-stakes testing as a means in which to determine how a school is doing?
I think it's easy. You know, I think it's, if you look at the history of public education in the United States, you know, in the past 200 years, we've been trying so hard to figure out why is it so difficult to raise student achievement, right? Our achievement gap, despite the fact that maybe overall test scores are going up in the United States, the gap remains stubbornly wide. I mean, in fact, in the last 10 years, it has increased slightly.
By so gap, the gap between what and what?
Between Latino and African-American students and white students. Okay. That gap has remained stubbornly wide. And so, you know, here come test scores, and it's sort of this data set that's actually seemingly easy. You know, it's easy to measure, it's easy to use, it's easy to manipulate in different ways. It's a lot easier than, and it's easier to explain, you know, to parents. It's easier for folks who don't understand much about sort of how learning happens or what goes on in the classroom to talk about it. It allows a lot of people who have never taught in the classrooms to talk about it and be a part of it. But it's really deceiving, and it's really kind of seducing us into this idea that, you know, if something is really easy to measure and manipulate and use, that it sort of leads to the right answers. That I think it made our questions much more sophisticated, but it hasn't necessarily led to any answers. And I think at this point, it's creating more harm than good. You know, the alternative, which is really what I'm hoping to advance this conversation to an alternative. And I think that the alternative is to look at grades and to look at the quality of classroom work, right? To actually support teachers to come up with their own tests, right? One size does not fit all. To come up with their own tests that measure the learning of their unique student bodies. Now, that is no question that it's expensive and it's complicated, and it requires a lot more dialogue with teachers and students and parents. And all of that takes time and costs money.
All right, well, I want to go back for a second. So there's this large gap between white and Latino and African-American students. How is that gap measured? How is that gap measured? In other words, we can say there's a gap in terms of, but what is that gap a function of? In other words, is it higher education rates? Is it graduation rates? What is it? I mean, you know, we talk about there being this gap in education gap, and I'm just curious as to how that's measured as opposed to, you know, the sort of the testing that becomes the testing regime under No Child Left Behind / Race to the Top.
Sure. Yeah, that's an excellent question. I mean, when folks refer to that, you know, in education reformers or reporters in the stories, I mean, they mostly talk about these standardized test scores, and that is that gap that remains stubborn. But it's not, you know, if we look at other data, we also have, you know, even though college acceptances among Latino and African American students are going up, they're still lower than white students and Asian American students. So that, you know, that gap remains in terms of graduation rates and in terms of college acceptance and enrollment. So it's not. I certainly didn't see, you know, evidence that it's closing in other areas. It exists and it is real.
I mean, I don't doubt that it exists. I'm just curious if there aren't other factors that are at play in terms of whether you're talking about college, you know, acceptance into college rates or other metrics. I mean, and the weird thing is, too, is that, you know, when you talk about the Mission High School, I mean, that higher education rate, I mean, you said it's in the 80s, right? The
80%. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, that seems to me to be fairly high.
I think I don't understand.
In other words, if there's a set of metrics that apply to determining the gap, why isn't that same metrics not used in terms of determining whether or not a school is successful?
That's what my story is all about. That's what I'm hoping would happen, is that we would use, this other data that's easily available. It's, looking at student work and grades is complicated, takes time, although I don't think that you can reform schools genuinely, authentically, reform schools and, provide necessary professional development for teachers without that. But let's say we can deal with this in the next 2 years. We don't have the time or the resources or political will to do that. There's this other data already out there, right? College acceptances and enrollment, graduation rates, attendance rates, parent and student satisfaction surveys, hugely important. Why aren't we asking students and parents how they feel about schools? They in my experience in the 18 months in this school and other schools, I've gone to schools in Compton and Oakland. Students and parents most of the time know who the good teachers are, good schools are, especially students, because parents increasingly look at test scores now. But students know that, they pay attention to teachers and what goes on in the school a lot more than test scores.
I mean, what do you think the reason is for that? I mean, because it just seems weird to me that you would say, like, okay, we have a problem in education. And I can tell because I look at this metric and that metric and this metric and that metric. So we're going to require accountability from schools, and we're going to develop an entirely new metric in which to determine whether or not they've reached that accountability. What accounts for that sort of like mutation, it seems to me? I guess I'm a little bit suspect. We started this conversation with a certain amount of providing a certain benefit of the doubt in terms of motivations behind these regimes, this testing regime. But I think tell me if you have a sense that the agenda behind these teaching regimes, I mean these accountability regimes, the high stakes testing, is one which serves other agendas.
Mm-hmm. I think that the coalition of people who are behind this is extremely, extremely diverse. I don't necessarily sort of see a unified agenda in this. I think you see everyone from folks like Scott Walker, who is, seems to be using it to kind of break up the right of unions to organize and collectively bargain, to teachers, former teachers of color from public schools who got frustrated with the bureaucracy or, didn't find the support or saw racism in their school. I mean, it's a very, very diverse coalition of people. And I think the only thing they could sort of agree on is that, math and reading should matter. That students in certain grades should be able to read at a certain level and manipulate numbers at a certain level. It's sort of this one thing that everyone could agree on how to move forward. And, I think that no one really realized how it's going to change the curriculum, how it's going to change our schools, and how it's going to actually create a lot more harm than good. But I think that coalition is slowly kind of breaking apart and is becoming, I think I see signs, for a more sophisticated conversation on how to, how to move forward and advance it and actually create something that really serves our most vulnerable students and not just, it's not just used to, as a political agenda, to bust unions or, there's also, of course, enormous amount of money floating, in testing companies, right? The textbook companies, testing. Now there's a whole new round of testing that's going to be coming out with Common Core. I mean, all of that is a part of it. But I think I do see, sort of signs of hope and that this conversation is moving forward.
Give me a sense of how that coalition is breaking up. And because, I mean, off the top of my head, I can see the different people in that that coalition that range, like you say, from the Scott Walkers, who are simply sort of using this as a mechanism in which to break up the teachers' unions. And I think that, you know, and I would place, you know, maybe rightly or wrongly, but just for the sake of argument, Scott Walker, and that's his primary goal, where others see breaking up of the teachers' unions is a mechanism to provide other reforms through the spectrum of people to where they are just frustrated and something needs to be done. And this is the easiest thing to get a bunch of people on board, to people who were caught up in the sort of the cinematography and the storytelling in Waiting for Superman. And maybe some of those people have come to sort of see Michelle Rey in a different light as you know, sort of as she starts to get more exposed as to what her agenda is and so on. But I'm curious as to, and then people who just sort of come from a corporate world who, you know, are used to sort of looking at a spreadsheet and saying, this is the way that I determine whether or not this division is doing well. And I act accordingly. Give me your sense of how those coalitions are breaking apart. And if you see, you know, what are some sort of real life implications to that coalition breaking apart?
You know, I think I don't really, unfortunately, see it playing out at this point yet in the public life, in the political arena. I'm not really seeing that. I still see, you know, Michelle Rhee really kind of sticking to her guns and, you know, insisting that student performance, she always refers to student performance. And what she really means is test scores. You know, when we talk about let's include we must include student achievement data in our teacher evaluations, you know, what she really means test scores. She's not talking about the quality of the actual classroom work that students produce over the course of a year, right? She's just talking about a test that they took for a week and maybe weren't feeling great that week, or who knows what else was going on in their life or how that test was administered, all sorts of things that I saw at Mission High School. And, you know, really talented people who run a lot of amazing charter schools are still, you know, I think that there's a lot of data out there that points to the fact that they do, you know, the poverty is very complicated, and that they end up teaching students at the sort of higher level, you know, among the poor students, right? Students who are very poor but who live in stable homes, who have, you know, parents who are engaged and are helping them after school. And of course, you know, they end up scoring higher, and then, you know, saying that that their model is superior to the public school like Mission, which has no choice. You know, and as I mentioned, a lot of students that end up there came from, I mean, I've met students from who actually left KIPP Middle School in San Francisco and went to Mission High School because they didn't like the sort of emphasis on discipline that they have there, or, you know, that they have to always walk with their shirt tucked in and things like that. Where they didn't feel noticed or respected, students who got kicked out from other public schools, right? So, you know, they have to educate, things like that. But I think that, but I do think that folks who have been behind, you know, the accountability slogan, I mean, we, you know, we look at the data, and the whole point behind it was to kind of close the achievement gap. And it's not really closing. I mean, we haven't really solved it. So it's not working. All these little things are not working. I mean, they still, I think that it's creating, overall, it's doing, you know, overall has a positive effect. And, you know, from what I've seen, I sort of feel like it's creating more harm than good.
The high stakes testing, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The stubborn, you know, the stubbornness to kind of insist that they measure more, that the test scores measure more than we know they do, and continuing to use it as the dominant tool for making all sorts of decisions, right, on whom to hire and fire. And, you know, in New York now, you know, student placement to certain schools is now, you know, increasingly determined by student test scores. And, of course, you know, a lot of decisions on which schools are going to stay open or not are based on that. I mean, a lot of states are looking, you know, there are states that that want to, you know, really insist on closing the bottom 10% lowest performing schools, and Mission High School is on that list.
And well, let's say Mission High School closed. Okay, I mean, just you know, by 2014, they have to raise their test scores. They already get it, you know, putting over 80% of their kids into higher education. But what happens when it closes? Okay, so that school's not there anymore. Where are the kids supposed to go? I mean, theoretically, they go into other schools, and is the idea that simply these kids, I mean, in other words, is the argument that these kids are going to go into other schools that are better performing schools and they're going to learn more, or is it simply that they're going to go in there and they're to the extent that they don't learn anything and it's reflected in the quality of the test scores, it'll be a statistical blip and it won't matter and those people will just sort of be washed through the system?
Mm-hmm.
I think all of the things
that you just mentioned would happen. I think, you know, the most important thing and the biggest loss to taxpayers and this country, you know, not besides the fact that it's incredibly disruptive to kids and families, it would be a huge loss because I think that it is, you know, it is at schools like Mission High where we're actually getting closer to some of these answers on how to close the achievement gap. I mean, they really are famous in the city for being successful with especially Latino students and African, you know, the picture with African-American students is mixed, but they're succeeding with them, you know, better than the average school in the city. Again, if you look at complex metrics, including college acceptance and enrollment rates, so it'd be a huge loss to taxpayers because unlike many high-scoring charter schools, you know, Mission High School, again, works with the most vulnerable kids, right? There's so many homeless kids and, you know, kids in foster care system. And, you know, again, the fact, you know, that a fifth of students have been in the U.S. for less than 5 years and show up at school without speaking any English. I mean, those are the schools that are getting us closer to the answers. And because we're using such a misguided, broken, overly simplistic instruments, we're not paying attention. You know, not only that, we're closing and breaking up something very authentic and real that's going on there and that's been in the works, you know, that's being built for 5 years. We could potentially disrupt it and throw it out the door and waste the money of the taxpayers.
Now, I mean, lastly, let me ask you, it seems to me that in all the conversations I've had with people who have reported on education, who have been educators themselves, that the difficulty that those people who are against the high-stakes testing regime have had is that it's very difficult to answer the question, what makes a school better? Because it is so contextualized. In the same way as like, you know, what's the best way to teach a student? Well, you got to tell me who the student is first, right? And that seems to be the problem. I mean, is that what can be taken? Is it possible to take lessons from Mission High School and apply them across the board in some way? I mean, that seems to be the disadvantage that the people who are against the so-called education reform movement have, in that they don't have a one-stop bumper sticker answer to how to make schools better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you just nailed it, Sam. That's I love the question and the comment, and that's exactly frustratingly what I found right after 18 months at the school, because I certainly was, you know, in the same boat. I wanted to go in and find, you know, a laundry list of 10 most effective, least expensive strategies that we can use, you know, in every school across the country. And yes, it's, you know, the answer depends on the student. But I think, you know, I think that the side that's arguing against, you know, the high stakes accountability approach that's, you know, one size fits all, that's way too simplistic. I think that, you know, we can all come up with better language. You know, to me personally, I sort of think of it less as a list of 10 things, but I'm thinking of it as sort of as a set of practices that all schools can adopt to their own unique you know, bodies of students. And to me, you know, it has to do with creating systems in which students and teachers together, you know, obviously this, the student voice and the role becomes increasingly more important in middle school and high school, but creating systems in which students and teachers can, you know, create sort of safe environments when they, where they can discuss together sort of, you know, what, how, you know, how are you learning? What motivates you? And then as teachers to ask, how, you know, how do we measure this learning? What's the best way, you know, what's the best evidence to measure this learning? And I think when those, you know, sets of practices are in every school, I think that's the only way you can raise student achievement. I just don't really see any other way around it, you know, and that has to do with classroom work and grades, and you're getting into these very micro details of the classroom work that, that goes on there. But I think that if you sort of scratch beneath the surface of some of the most, you know, highly successful schools, I think that, you know, what they do is going to be very different, but how they do it is going to be very similar.
Interesting. So it's a the solution is a process as opposed to a specific.
I think so. It's, you know, it's creating reflective. It's inserting a lot more reflection into their craft, and then attaching, you know, coaching, mentorship, right? But there's also accountability, and accountability is that you look at what the students produce. You know, what did the student produce over the course of the year in your class? Let's look at it. How did you measure it? How did you adjust your practice based on that, right? It's the set of practices around empowerment and reflection, which includes accountability.
Christina Rizga, contributing writer to Mother Jones Magazine. The piece is Everything You've Heard About Failing Schools is Wrong. It is in this September-October issue of Mother Jones. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Sam, for very thoughtful questions. It's been an honor to be on your show.
Oh, well, I'm glad to feel that. We will have you back when you how many more months do you have at the school?
I'm going back for another year, and I'm actually writing a book about that experience, so I'd love to report back in a year.
Love to hear from you. Okay, good luck.
Thank you. Thank you, Sam. Bye-bye. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.